I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. In November 2020, the day after Election Day, President Trump declared that he had beaten Joe Biden in Pennsylvania. That short-lived victory was undone when all the mail-in ballots were counted, giving Biden 80,000 more votes than Trump and the Commonwealth's 20 Electoral College votes. 8 months later, Republican State Senator Doug Mastriano, who's an ardent Trump supporter and has spread conspiracy theories and misinformation about the election, has called for a forensic audit of the election results in three counties, including in Philadelphia. Mastriano has said his investigation is modeled on the review happening in Arizona. Now, the Brennan Center called the Arizona audit a sham to sow doubt about the legitimacy of President Biden's election. We asked Al Schmidt to join us. He's Republican Philadelphia City Commissioner, Vice Chair of the Board of Elections, who faced death threats doing his job during the 2020 election. But first, here's a clip of President Biden speaking yesterday in Philadelphia about the threats to the right to vote.
All told, more than 150 Americans of every age, of every race, of every background exercised their right to vote. They voted early. They voted absentee. They voted in person. They voted by mail. They voted by Dropbox. And then they got their families and friends to go out and vote. Election officials, the entire electoral system, withstood unrelenting political attacks, physical threats, intimidation, and pressure. They did so with unyielding courage and faith in our democracy.
Al Schmidt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I know you had death threats after the 2020 election, shortly after the election. Do you still get death threats?
No, fortunately, they've let up after the president was inaugurated. All that sort of subsided.
There's a study that came out last month from the Brennan Center that looked at threats to elected officials, including people like yourself, finding that one in three felt unsafe. One in five had threats to their life. Does that square with not just your experience, but from other election officials?
It does. And it's a very comprehensive report. It's very well done. And unfortunately, my case is not unique at all. And it's not unique to Democrats, and it's not unique to Republicans. It's something that's gone on all over the country where election administrators are targeted in this way.
I was reading that even your family was threatened.
That's correct.
What did you do to be able to protect yourself? And I realize I don't want to put you in any danger by having you answer that question.
The city, there were two levels of response. At the local level, the city government provided a security detail, 24 hours a day for me and my family. So when we took the kids sledding in the snow, two detectives went with us. When you walk the dog, two detectives go with you. It was just an around-the-clock presence. And again, this is probably not a unique situation. At the federal level, obviously, they're investigating to try to get at, who was behind these threats to me and others.
What was it like to live under that level of stress and anxiety?
Well, there was plenty of stress and anxiety to begin with, given that we were running the presidential election in probably the biggest city and the biggest swing state in the country. And despite the results not being close at all in Pennsylvania, like you said, 80,000 votes between the Biden and Trump, there was already plenty of stress. The most important thing was to not let those threats distract us from doing our job. That's the point, right? The point is to coerce, to get you to do something that you otherwise wouldn't do, or not do something that you need to do. So it was important not to let that be successful.
The president called you out?
Yes, in a tweet by name. And that's really when it escalated and became far more detailed in nature.
Scary. This is what, your third term as a city commissioner?
It is. I was elected in 2011 and then reelected in 15 and 19.
So have you ever, faced this level of vitriol and political partisanship, even beyond partisanship?
No.
Warfare.
No, and I don't know you know, as the president said yesterday, this is probably the biggest challenge our democracy has faced since the Civil War. And I know that sounds over the top, but, you know, in my previous life, I have a PhD in history. So it's something I think a lot about. I think about all of this through the prism of history and exactly what's going on right now.
What do you think is going on right now then? Where did this come from?
I think we are at a really critical juncture in the history of our republic right now, and that it is far more fragile than any of us ever realized. And maybe we've taken it for granted that this American experiment and this system of government that we have, which is better than any other, is really at risk of falling apart. I think the most intriguing thing to me, intriguing in a unpleasant way, I guess, is that that obviously that would have been an environment that the former president and his followers exploited to sort of bring this about. It didn't just come out of nowhere. There was something there. There was a fertile environment there for these sort of things to take root.
It does raise a series of questions about our system, you know, system of government, our court system. And in a sort of ironic way, this was, as President Biden referenced yesterday, the most safe and secure election we have probably ever had. I think more people voted in 2020 than ever before. We're obviously a bigger country than we were, you know, a generation ago. But nonetheless, in many ways, it was an extraordinarily successful election. And yet here we are.
It is. And it's so perverse that instead of us embracing it and celebrating that we had such incredibly high turnout throughout the country in cities and suburbs and in rural areas, that our election system is more safe and secure than ever, especially in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, where we have voter verifiable paper ballots so that the voter can actually see the votes that they're the vote that they're casting to verify it before they finally press the vote button. And yet we find ourselves in a place where a doubt is being cast over all of it.
Let me ask you about the state senator Mastriano. I mentioned that in my introduction. He has requested information from three counties, Tioga, York, and Philadelphia. He wants an audit, I guess, of the election. What specifically is he asking for?
Well, he's pretty much asking for everything.
Meaning voting machines?
Yes. It's not just a matter of ballots and all the election materials. It's also the voting system, the tabulators, the programming equipment, and all of that. And as you saw in Arizona, they are going to need to acquire all new equipment. And the Pennsylvania Department of State made clear in a directive to all the counties the other day that if counties comply with this, that we will have to they will decertify our election equipment because it will have been handed over to third parties and would no longer be secure.
We're talking about millions of dollars then,
tens
right?
of millions of
tens
dollars,
of
yes.
millions of dollars
with a system we just acquired in 2019 at great expense.
So what are some of the, without giving too much away, what are the deliberations then among county commissioners here in Philadelphia?
Yeah, we received the letter and are reviewing
it. And there's a deadline,
it.
I should say, the end of the month.
That's right. And we'll give it the appropriate amount of consideration that it warrants and then have a response to the letter in the days ahead.
You chose your words very carefully. Appropriate amount of response that is warranted.
Correct.
You're going to leave it there?
I will.
Interesting, the Attorney General Josh Shapiro is more outspoken about this, is saying essentially, over my dead body. And that's not a quote from him, obviously.
Yeah, he has. And he has been really at the forefront of a lot of these kind of assaults on voter accessibility and voter rights going on right now in the Commonwealth, and is really, I think, taking a leadership kind of role in fending off a lot of that. There was no shortage of litigation in the 2020 election.
No. How many lawsuits in Pennsylvania?
I don't even know. Because we also had the city solicitor's office. We had outside counsel. We had the attorney general. We had just – it was one after another, and we won them all, obviously, because there was no merit to them. You know, a lot of this gets fought in the courts. So that's why I think the Attorney General's role is so important right now.
Have you talked directly, or has Senator Mastriano spoken to you or spoken to other commissioners about what he is looking for?
No, I've never spoken with him. And I am sincerely grateful for his prior service to our country.
But
right now, he is. But right now, he is doing our country a great disservice, and that is spreading lies about the 2020 election and sort of playing into this paranoid fantasy that it was stolen.
Here's a quote from him. This investigation is not about overturning the results of either election. The goals are to restore faith in the integrity of our system, confirm the effectiveness of existing legislation on the governance of elections, and identify areas for legislative reform. What do you say to that?
Well, to state the obvious, if the goal were to alleviate all of this manufactured concern about the integrity of the election, the best and most important thing to do would be to stop lying. That fundamentally is the key to the whole thing, because it's sort of feeding itself. It should be easy for my fellow Republicans to rebuke all of this, but it's almost like something has started that they can't stop. They can't sort of stop feeding this into this lie that's going on. And I have no doubt they're hearing from their constituents, and I have no doubt they're trying to be responsive to their constituents, but they're the ones creating this sort of manufactured doubt about the last election. We've audited our election twice in Philadelphia, as did counties across the Commonwealth.
You're a Republican. What does it say about your party?
I am a Republican, and I'm also a former senior auditor for the federal government at GAO. So I don't throw the term audit around particularly easily. And I have a feeling a lot of people have no idea what they're talking about. What is going on in Arizona, it does not resemble anything like an audit following any generally accepted auditing standards or principles or anything like that. It's carried out by partisan political operatives funded by partisan political benefactors to achieve a partisan political purpose, which is to sow doubt in the election.
We're almost out of time here. Will the system hold?
It's got to. We have no choice. I mean, I'm probably misquoting Churchill or someone, but, you know, we have the worst system of government except for any other. And that is really what's on the line here.
Well, Al Schmidt, I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times, coming into the studio and telling us about yourself and our system. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, Philadelphia City Commissioner, Republican Vice Chair of the Board of Elections. We're going to expand our horizons, talk more nationally about the threat to the right to vote after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Speaking yesterday in Philadelphia, President Biden issued a forceful condemnation of efforts in Republican-controlled state governments to restrict the right to vote.
There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote in fair and free elections. An assault on democracy, an assault on liberty, an assault on who we are as Americans. For make no mistake, bullies and merchants of fear, peddlers of lies, are threatening the very foundation of our country. It gives me no pleasure to say this. I never thought in my entire career I'd ever have to say it. But I swore an oath to you, to God, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And that's an oath that forms a sacred trust to defend America against all threats, both foreign and domestic.
Biden was referring to new voter ID requirements, restricted poll access, tighter deadlines, rollbacks of mail-in voting and election audits that are being debated and voted on in many states, including Pennsylvania. We just talked with Philadelphia Republican City Commissioner Al Schmidt about a Republican state senator's demand for an audit of the 2020 presidential election in Pennsylvania. Now we want to get a national perspective to discuss restrictive voting bills across the nation, stalled legislation in Congress, and a recent Supreme Court decision that will impact voters. And we have two guests who have joined us. Josh Douglas is a professor of election law and voting rights at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg School of Law, author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Josh Douglas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
And also with us is Sophia Lynn Lakin, Deputy Director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project. And Sophia Lynn Lakin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. We've got a lot to talk about. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me just get a response to a couple of things that Al Schmidt was telling us before you joined our conversation. And Sophia, I'll begin with you talking about the kind of death threats that elected officials and people working at polls, the kind of lack of safety that they felt as a result of working in the 2020 election. What does that tell us, Sophia?
It's just one really disconcerting and unfortunate trend, I would say, part of the nothing less than the full-scale assault on voting rights to be attacking our elections officials, who we should be celebrating, for pulling off a successful election under the most troubling and difficult circumstances in this past year. So I find it a very, very horrifying state of affairs.
And to you, Josh Douglas, are you worried that that people will say, you know, it isn't worth it for me to work the polls on Election Day?
Well, we're already seeing that. We're seeing a large turnover of these American heroes. And, you know, this is one of the things that makes me most angry about what's going on right now to our democracy, is this attack on the frontline workers, these professional election administrators, who really are the heroes of the 2020 election, pulled off an impossible stunt of running a smooth and fair election during a pandemic amidst the, you know, a constant attacks on the integrity of the process. And they did such a great job, and we're seeing that throughout the country right now with people retiring, and there's going to be a real problem in the next election cycles if we don't have enough professional election workers.
And it wasn't a stunt, just to make sure we get our language right there, Josh.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, this is real, you know, real threats, you know, death threats that are people having from the, you know, top of the election officials, statewide secretaries of state, all the way down to poll workers who are facing serious threats, you know, and real world implications. And, you know, a lot of them are saying it's not worth it, unfortunately, even though they did such an incredible job during the 2020 election.
Sophia, we also talked about an audit in Pennsylvania looking at three counties, Philadelphia being one, two that actually voted for Trump. And the state senator says this is really modeled on what is happening in Maricopa County in Arizona. Help us understand what is happening in Maricopa County, Arizona, Sophia.
Well, I think Commissioner Schmidt, who spoke about some of these efforts, is right that it's an attempt to continue to feed this big lie that has been perpetuated through for months and months and months now, that there's been something wrong, that there's been a concern about the elections that already happened, and laying the groundwork potentially for continuing to cast doubt on elections even after the fact. And so what's happening in Maricopa is one example of that kind of effort. And unfortunately, we are seeing, for example, in Pennsylvania itself, attempts to replicate that effort across the country.
And to you, Josh Douglas, is the message, and I don't know how coordinated it is the message that no matter who you are, no matter how you voted, you cannot trust the system?
Well, I think what they're trying to say is that you can't trust the results of the 2020 election, and they're using that as a rallying cry, perhaps, for undermining the Biden presidency, for undermining the potential of losses in 2022 and 2024. You know, it's just like this mantra of voter fraud, which is virtually non-existent, the fact of voter fraud. But I think the feeling is if you say it enough times, people start to believe it. And, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of audits if done the right way. There are professional audits that you can do. And that every state actually does, has a post-election process. But this nonsense in Arizona is not the proper way to do it. It can't be trusted.
Well, let me go back to President Biden, again, speaking yesterday in Philadelphia. And this is where he talks about who gets to count the counts. Let's give it a listen.
21st century Jim Crow assault is real. It's unrelenting. And we're going to challenge it vigorously. While this broad assault against voting rights is not unprecedented, it's taking on a new and literally pernicious forms. It's no longer just about who gets to vote or making it easier for eligible voters to vote. It's about who gets to count the vote. Who gets to count whether or not your vote counted at all. It's about moving from independent election administrators who work for the people to polarized state legislatures and partisan actors who work for political parties. To me, this is simple. This is election subversion. It's the most dangerous threat to voting and the integrity of free and fair elections in our history. Never before have they decided who gets to count what votes count.
Sophia, can you speak to that, the idea of who gets to decide the election results, who gets to count the votes?
Absolutely. This is another example of a widespread push, something that is new this year, and it's a blatant attempt to punish and restrict local officials who responded, as we discussed, to the challenge of last year's elections, conducting this election during a global pandemic by taking common sense actions to ensure voters could vote and vote safely. And we are seeing elections officials already being removed for taking these common sense actions to make voting accessible during difficult times, during regular times, doing things that are aimed at ensuring that voters can actually vote in our democratic process. So it's extremely disconcerting to see states coming in and having these new rules and new subversive tactics, as the president said, to really overturn and punish elections officials who are doing their job and really trying to be responsive to the voters themselves, which is what we should be doing, as opposed to trying to subvert elections for partisan gains.
Can you speak to that, Josh Douglas? You had a piece recently sort of talking about how things are becoming criminalized.
Yeah, you know, this is another part of the multi-pronged attack on our democracy and the way in which we run our elections. You have new state laws that are making it a crime for local election officials to essentially make a mistake or make a decision that helps voters. And in some of these new state laws, local election officials not only will be subject to fines, but they'd be subject to jail time. You know, talk about disincentivizing these individuals from working in these vital responsibilities, these vital jobs. And what you see is state legislatures taking the power from professional election administrators who are doing their jobs in a nonpartisan way and placing it within partisan bodies. And just saying it, I think, demonstrates the absurdity. You know, it shouldn't be fair for one side or the other to dictate the rules or dictate who gets to decide the rules. So I'm glad President Biden highlighted this problem. It's something that we're seeing, you know, kind of under the surface, but really important to call out and to stop because professional election administrators are what saved the 2020 election, not partisan legislators.
And that is Josh Douglas, a professor of election law and voting rights at the University of Kentucky's Rosenberg School of Law, wrote a book called Vote for Us, how to take back our elections and change the future of voting. Also with us, Sophia Lynn Lakin, Deputy Director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project. And yes, we are talking about the right to vote today on Radio Times, and we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Sophia, Kurt has a question here. Almost everyone has a photo driver's license. Why not use this state-issued document as a confirming ID for voting? Voting ID is I don't know if it ever went away, but it seems like it's coming back. What's wrong with voter ID?
So I want to, you know, just be clear about what we're talking about when we're talking about voter ID. Voter ID can be a lot of different things. What I would say we are most concerned about is the kinds of laws that require certain kinds of IDs that and restrict voters from using other kinds of IDs. And what we see is that legislatures, time and time again, these are the devils are always in the details, setting forth rules on voter identification that really impose a very, very a difficult burden on especially marginalized communities, historically disenfranchised voters, Black and brown voters in particular. We see this time and time again in our studies. In our cases and so forth. So that is the issue when it comes to identification, that there needs to be some sort of safety hatch for these voters who do have difficulties, which we have shown time and time again, obtaining the kinds of IDs that the state is willing to accept, and ensuring that they aren't disenfranchised simply because they don't have those identification.
And Josh Douglas, what I don't want to paint too broad a brush, but frankly, what a lot of Republicans are saying is that we need all of this because of voter fraud. We have to deal with the problem of voter fraud. Just how pernicious a problem is that in America?
Right. So a photo ID requirement, and I agree with everything that Sophia says about, you know, not everyone does have a qualifying ID in some states. But the other flip side of the equation is, what are we preventing? And a photo ID requirement stops only one kind of potential voter fraud. That's in-person impersonation. I show up to the polls and pretend I'm someone I'm not. And that just doesn't happen. You know, I'm not trying to say that election fraud never happens. It's very, very rare, but there are isolated incidents. But in-person impersonation is almost non-existent. It's a really dumb way to try to throw an election, in fact. I mean, you need a lot of people to do it to make a difference, and you're likely to get caught. And just we know people have been looking for the boogeyman for years. We know it just doesn't happen. So if you want to do a cost-benefit analysis, the cost on people without an ID is very high for those who don't have one. And the benefit to election integrity is virtually nothing because this kind of voter fraud simply doesn't exist.
Sophia, every now and then there's someone who there was a Texas man who went to the polls, apparently stood in line for 5 or 6 hours to vote. He had served time in prison. I believe he was still on parole. He voted and now he is in big trouble. But that has been used as a way to say, look, voter fraud is something we need to address.
Yes, absolutely. And the ACLU and the ACLU of Texas are representing Hervis Rogers in his criminal case in Texas. And it is one example, along with an example of another individual in Texas, Crystal Mason, who similarly was prosecuted and in her case eventually convicted for what amounts to an innocent mistake. And from our perspective, it's simply part of this overcriminalization of the ballot box that we discussed very, very briefly with respect to the actual elections officials themselves. It's another attempt at voter intimidation at voters to manufacture this record, supposedly, of voter fraud that doesn't exist. I think it's an attempt to really feed and continue that lie, that myth that supposedly there's some, you know, background of voter fraud out there that needs to be corrected that justifies these laws. But as Josh points out, what happened in Texas, an individual who makes an innocent mistake and really believes that he's doing the right thing and performing his civic duty, which we should all be celebrating, instead finds that he is facing decades in prison. This is not the kind of issue or concern, even if we were to be concerned about it in this particular case, that would be prevented by a voter identification requirement. So a lot of times that's what we're seeing. We're seeing ambiguous statements that there is fraud out there, but the laws that we're seeing, the restrictions that are being imposed have nothing to do with any of the, on the other hand, kinds of things that people are pointing to as supposed voter fraud.
Josh, we're almost on a break here, but at the same time, you know, Democrats in Congress, and it sounded like President Biden yesterday, were talking about things that the federal government can do to protect the right to vote. Is that a good investment?
You know, I'm of the mindset that if we can have bipartisanship in election rules, that's the best way to go. We did that in Kentucky, where we had a voter expansion law that also improved integrity. And so, you know, Congress certainly has the constitutional power to impose federal rules, and everything in the For the People Act is great policy. But I would, you know, I think to enhance legitimacy, if we can find a way to talk to each other on both sides, that's better. The question, of course, is, will the Republicans even come to the negotiating table at all?
Do you want to add to that, Sophia?
I agree with everything that's been said here. You know, it's been very frustrating to see the inaction, and at the same time, obviously the goals of bipartisanship are important ones. At the same time, democracy needs action now.
Okay, well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Sophia Lynn Lakin. She is Deputy Director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project, joining us by Skype. Josh Douglas, Professor of Election Law and Voting Rights at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg School of Law, wrote a book called Vote for Us, and we are talking about preserving the right to vote, protecting the right to vote, and some of the challenges happening in states across the country, including here in Pennsylvania. I'll read a bunch of comments after this very short break. We got a lot of listeners with a lot of opinions. Send them to us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9400. 99. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne, talking with our guests about attempts in Pennsylvania and other states around the country to pass more restrictive voting laws and to relitigate the 2020 election. Before I play one more clip from President Biden yesterday in Philadelphia, a bunch of comments. Bill says the logical thing to do when your party loses an election is to change your party to appeal to more people. The current Republican game plan is typical of their short-term thinking. Unfortunately, it could have damaging results that would last for many years. Debbie asks, remind me again how it is that the election results showing Biden won are not valid, but those for other Republicans who won various seats in local and federal elections are valid. A similar comment from Don, if the election was stolen, why didn't the Democrats gain control of both houses? He says, because Trump is lying. A tweet from ATB Judge, do you think that part of the big lie is to keep Trump voters enthusiastic by telling them they won? They can avoid losing interest because they maxed out their vote and still lost. Let me play one more clip. And again, this was President Biden speaking yesterday, referring to a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Just weeks ago, Supreme Court yet again weakened the Voting Rights Act and upheld what Justice Kagan called, quote, a significant race-based disparity in voting opportunities. The court's decision, as harmful as it is, does not limit the Congress's ability to repair the damage done. That's the important point. It puts the burden back on Congress to restore the Voting Rights Act to its intended strength. As soon as Congress passes the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, I will sign it and let the whole world see it. That will be an important moment.
to you, Josh Douglas, talk about the Supreme Court decision he was referring to involving Arizona.
So this case involves two Arizona laws that the plaintiffs argued made it harder for racial minorities to vote. And the holding that upholds these two provisions, one about ballot collection, who can take your ballot and deliver it, the other about if you show up at the wrong precinct and still cast a vote and that won't count. And the court upheld those, but that holding is really not the important part of this decision. What's really important is what the court said about the Voting Rights Act, particularly Section 2 of the law. And essentially what the court did was made it extremely difficult for plaintiffs to win these cases. Justice Alito's majority opinion set out 5 guideposts for determining whether a rule violates Section 2, which says you can't have a law that has a discriminatory effect on racial minorities. But each of these 5 guideposts are not neutral. They all favor the states and put a thumb in the scale to uphold laws, make it very difficult for plaintiffs to win these kinds of cases.
Sophia Lynn Lakin, do we have a Voting Rights Act?
We absolutely still have a Voting Rights Act. There are other provisions of the Voting Rights Act that haven't been affected either by this decision, this recent decision out of Arizona, or by the Shelby County decision, which has been spoken about, which gutted a different provision of the Voting Rights Act, and that we are all attempting to have restored. As just pointed out, as someone who litigates these cases time and time again, I will say that the guideposts that have been laid out by the court will, as a very practical matter, make it very difficult, much more resource intensive, really highlights the need why case by case kind of litigation here, using the courts as a backstop, is not the answer, although obviously an important tool.
Well, what can Congress, I mean, you know, whether this will pass in Congress or not is a very big question. But the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, to you, Sophia Lynn Lakin, would that address some of the problems we've been talking about?
Absolutely. As I said, for the time, democracy can't wait. The time to act is now. Many of the provisions in both the For the People Act as well as in the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act would solve many of these problems. Some of the restrictive bills that we are seeing introduced, over 430, I think, at the last count, would likely not have even been introduced had the VRAA been enacted as of now, or that Shelby County hadn't happened. So it would absolutely change the game in terms of what we're seeing out of the states, and would really, really do a lot to ensure that racial discrimination in voting doesn't persist, which is obviously one of the main concerns that we have here.
Josh Douglas, let me ask a question in a different way. How easy should it be to vote?
It should be extremely easy. I mean, the right to vote is the most fundamental right in our democracy. You know, as the Declaration of Independence says, the government is legitimate based on the consent of the governed, and the governed includes all of us. And, you know, anytime you put up unnecessary hurdles to the ballot box, that makes our democracy weaker. And so the provisions in the For the People Act would seek to enhance our democracy by making it that much stronger.
I'm looking at an article, actually, it was in the Washington Post just a couple of weeks ago. I'll put this to you, Sophia. More than half of U.S. states have lowered some barriers to voting since the 2020 election, making permanent practices that helped produce record voter turnout during the coronavirus pandemic, talking about Vermont to California. We do focus, I think, largely on states that are restricting the right to vote, but this article is about states that have actually making it easier to vote.
Yes, and that's the news that often does get lost, that there are attempts on the other hand to really solidify and celebrate the gains that we've seen over time and continue efforts to provide good voter service, to make it accessible for voters, to increase turnout. The United States is, sadly, despite the historic turnout, not one of the high performers when it comes to participation in our democratic process, and we should be doing everything we can to celebrate that. It's one of the pieces of silver linings, good news, pieces that I point to often when people ask, what can we do? What are things that can be done? We are seeing some places really do take action at the local state level to make voting accessible and easier and fair, and uplifting those instances is really important.
Josh Douglas, going back to Pennsylvania, actually going back to 2020, there were numerous legal challenges, some of them in federal courts, some of them in state courts. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court got involved. The U.S. Supreme Court did not get involved, but there were a couple of cases that made it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Can we say, and basically the courts in Pennsylvania said the election stands, there wasn't voter fraud, Biden is the duly elected nominee from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Can we say our legal system held?
Well, it held after the 2020 election with respect to the post-election litigation. And there was, you know, lawsuits filed all over the country in, you know, the six or seven key swing states, and the courts and nominees of Democrats and Republicans upheld the rule of law in a post-election dispute. That's very different from the litigation we talked about with respect to the Supreme Court and the Voting Rights Act. And the lawsuits we saw in 2020 before the election, I think, were very concerning with respect to upholding the right to vote. But these cases are just vastly different when you're trying to challenge an election that has already occurred, as opposed to litigate the rules by which we run the election. If I can, Marty, real quick,
sure, go
back
ahead
to something that Sophia said, though, because I don't want to lose this point about the good news in voting rights, and partially because I wrote an entire book about the good news in voting
fair
rights.
Fair enough, yes.
In the ways in which states and localities are making it easier to vote. And the For the People Act takes basically most of the things that are happening in some states that are good, and they're in, you know, so-called blue states like Oregon and so-called red states like Utah and even purple states like Colorado, places that do run their elections really well, and essentially nationalizes those good rules. And so there is a lot of good news in localities and places all over the country where we're making it easier to access the ballot, adopting, you know, vote by mail, ranked choice voting, lots of reforms, registration barriers, cutting down the barriers to register to vote. And so these things are happening all over the country. And, you know, it's important to look at the starting place in the states. I'm in Kentucky, so I like to highlight the good news that we had. And it became a national story that, you know, this red state passed a law that actually made it easier to vote after the pandemic. And, you know, it's not as good as a lot of other states. We only have now 3 days of early voting, which isn't enough. But we started with zero. And so there is progress being made, and it's possible, but we need to have those conversations and highlight those places that are doing it.
And again, that's Josh Douglas, who joins us along with Sophia Lynn Lakin. We are talking about voting in America. And again, you can join our conversation. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Sophia, I'm not sure exactly how to put this question, so I'll just put it out there. But I was thinking of, if you've got lawyers like Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, and Lynn Wood arguing your cases, and I was reading about what a judge in Michigan has been saying about their legal arguments challenging some of the voting rights in that state, should we be quaking in our boots?
Well, I think that the courts are doing the right thing to investigate the claims that were being made and call out the lies that were put forth in the lawsuits themselves. So, you know, while these cases that were brought post-election for the most part by these different individuals were not, I would say, the strongest lawsuits out there, and they were certainly based on false allegations in many instances. Hard to say what will come next. Mm-hmm. And that is what I think most of us are thinking about and preparing for. It did certainly help, I think, the cause of democracy for these cases to be litigated so poorly. And the claims obviously being baseless, but the courts have seemed at least somewhat open to entertaining the claim. And so just the fight might be much more difficult if other resources are brought to bear.
What do you think, Josh?
Well, you know, we're starting to see some sanctions hearings against some of these lawyers. And Rudy Giuliani was, I believe he was disbarred out of New York, or at least there's proceedings for that to happen. And, you know, so it is good to see that courts are not taking kindly to these frivolous lawsuits that were filed really as a political stunt and not a, actual litigation strategy because they didn't have a real case. I'd like to watch what the courts do here. I do think that in many of these cases, sanctions are appropriate. And so we'll see that what happens with the courts in these situations.
Here's a tweet from Roy. The economy has been run for 40 years by the donor class. Along comes a populist demagogue who tells them only he can fix their problems. And they believe him because they had nowhere to go due to both parties selling out their country. Sophia, what do you think of that? That this stuff didn't come from nowhere, if you know what I mean.
You're right. I'm not sure I fully understand precisely what the question is getting at, but.
Well, I think he's getting at the fact that this came up with Al Schmidt, is that the sort of angry vitriol that we hear now, fed from several different angles, including former President Trump, that didn't come from nowhere, that people were sort of primed and pumped to be frustrated and angry with the system.
I think that's absolutely correct, especially in the case of the 2020 election. We saw already setting the stage prior to any of the lawsuits themselves really playing out. But this concept is that there might be something wrong with the election, that we should all be concerned about mail voting, we should be concerned about drop boxes and so forth, so that it laid the stage that there for the challenges after the fact. I think that's continuing to be the case. And, you know, when we talk about, and this is one of the frustrating elements, I would say, of the Supreme Court decision that came out, sort of the canonization of the idea of voter fraud as something that is a legitimate interest. Who is manufacturing and creating the lack of supposed lack of voter confidence? Who is not confident also in the election results and using that as the back end way to justify these laws? When those are lies that are manufactured by the people that are trying to promote them in the first instance, then we sort of have a self-fulfilling prophecy, to put it one way.
Josh, we're almost out of time, but since you mentioned, you know, various ways of voting, what did you make of the mayoral race in New York City?
Well, that was used ranked choice voting, which a handful of cities have used now. And essentially, instead of having to choose just one candidate among many, voters can rank order their preferences. But this is not the first time it was used. In fact, in 2020, it was used in Maine statewide. So it's a system that brings more voices into the process. It, you know, means that you don't have to vote for the lesser of two evils. And so I think the system really worked. I mean, the Board of Elections had a little hiccup in terms of its reporting of the results, but the process itself worked really well, and I think it's going to continue to grow in popularity.
And you think it should?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a way that it can help campaigns because campaigns will be a little bit less negative. Instead of going negative against your opponent, you want at least the supporters of that person to rank you as number two if they're not going to put you as number one. It brings more people into the process. There's studies that show that it helps women become elected, more likely to be elected, and minorities. So there's just a lot of great things in terms of getting a better reflection of what the voters actually want.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Josh Douglas, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And he's a professor of election law and voting rights at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg School of Law. Sophia Lynn Lakin, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Deputy Director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project. And we began with Al Schmidt, Republican Philadelphia City Commissioner, talking about voting. Go to WHYY.org. And look for Radio Times under programs. I have to program myself to say that correctly. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.